Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, now offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts, with benefits that fit a variety of lifestyles and financial needs. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
So how would you describe the Merkel Hotel?
What I remember from the first time I walked in was the ceiling fan in the lobby and the dust being kind of heaped so high on top of the ceiling fan that it was like spilling off. And that gives you a sense of what kind of building this is. It is, for lack of a better term, a flop house. It's in this kind of off-the-beaten-path part of Tacoma near the intersection of two highways, and the reason I'm reporting on it is because it's going away.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. I'm here with KNKX South Sound reporter Will James. You're listening to Sound Effect, and Will's been covering this story for a little while now. How did you get hip to this story?
Well, there used to be really, really cheap hotels, motels, apartment buildings where you could easily get a room for very low cost. And the Merkel Hotel is, as far as I know, the last of those buildings in Tacoma. The last of that kind of unofficial safety net that was the line between being housed and being homeless for a lot of people. I've spoken to a lot of people who have already become homeless. I had never, as far as I know, spoken to people during the process of becoming homeless. Unfortunately, this case of the Merkel Hotel, which is going away, it's been bought by a developer and is being renovated, was an opportunity to see that process in action.
So when you first went there, what phase were they in the process of, you know, winding down?
When I was there, there were about 15 people left the first time. And when I visited them again a few days later, the day that they were supposed to move out, they were down to 9 people.
So what's become of those 9 people?
I checked in with their caseworker a little while ago, and 7 of them at this point are either homeless or, you know, on the verge of homelessness. They might be crashing on someone's couch for a few days. One of them's in the hospital, but as soon as he gets released, he has nowhere to go. So 7 out of 9 at this point are basically unhoused.
Can you tell us a little bit about one of them?
I met this guy, Leonard, who has lived in the building a couple of years. Like a lot of people at the Merkel Hotel, he was homeless before he moved in there. And I met him a few days before the deadline for him to move out. And he was just full of like hope and plans. He had all these ideas. He was going to get on a Greyhound bus and head to Yakima and find a place where he could live 150 miles away, where rents were cheaper, that he could afford. And he wasn't happy about it because he didn't know anything about Yakima. But he was like, if this is what I have to do to survive, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to figure it out. And the guy just had so much energy. And then I saw him again on October 31st, the day he had to move out. And I was like, yo, Leonard, what's going on? Did you get to Yakima? He's like, no, I never made it to Yakima. I think something's going to work out. He was like really vague about what was going to happen to him. And I kept kind of pressing him like, you know, where are you sleeping tonight, Leonard? Like the deadline's now, like, tell me what you're going to do tonight. And finally he said, listen, man, I don't know where I'm going to sleep tonight. I don't know.
I really don't. I'm not playing it by ear. I'm just playing it as for what it is, you know? Playtime's over with, to be honest with you. It's a rough world out there. And homelessness, it makes it even rougher. Being homelessness means that you got to be on your guard 24/7. You know, now, I didn't choose to be homelessness. I didn't choose to end up like this. And I'm imagining no one here ended up, you know, in this situation. But a lot of people had left. That's because they could.
To watch him go from this state of kind of like hope and planning and strategizing to the reality of his situation sinking in was really striking in my memory.
And you said you had never before this story seen the process of going from housed to homeless. What about that surprised you?
I remember being there on October 31st, the deadline to move out, and some of the remaining tenants were just kind of sitting in silence. They're kind of subdued. What surprised me was how quiet and anticlimactic it was.
Thanks so much, Will.
Thanks, Gabe.
Today on Sound Effect, our theme is safety net, that last line of defense between us and calamity. So we'll have stories about when that net does its job and what happens when it doesn't. As Will mentioned, the Merkel is a vestige of this whole lost category of housing, the residential hotel. These buildings once filled a crucial niche for low-income workers and immigrants, a bridge between affordable housing and something like a shelter. These single-room occupancy hotels, or SROs, used to dominate the streetscape in Seattle's Chinatown International District. Now they're nearly extinct. It's a story that caught the attention of Marie Wong, an associate professor at Seattle University. It appealed to her background in urban planning, but also to her background as a Chinese American growing up in the Midwest.
It wasn't until I started talking with people in the district that I realized that it was the same type of building that my father chose for us to stay in when we would go from Iowa to the Chinese restaurants that were in Minneapolis, Rochester, and Chicago. And every time we would go to one of these cities, my dad wanted to stay in one of these buildings. Every fall, he would do the harvest, and we had apple trees and pear trees, and he would grow Chinese vegetables, and they would share news of China, news about people that they would collectively know. And he would bring them fresh fruits and vegetables, and in exchange, they would give him meats and fish and that sort of thing. So that was kind of the annual fall trip. This was around the time period when, you know, motels were showing up all over the place on highways and freeways outside of central cities. And that's where we wanted to stay, but that's not where my dad wanted to stay.
Why do you think that is?
You know, I think that a lot of it may have had to do with the fact that this is where he stayed when he was an immigrant into the United States, because it would have fit that same time period. That my dad was also one of those transient laborers, that he did a lot of work. In fact, he was a cook in the restaurants when he was traveling throughout the United States. And this was the place where he could connect with people that he knew. So that was as important to him as staying in any other hotel or any other motel that would have been existing in the city.
And what are residential hotels? How are they different from a Days Inn?
Well, they were constructed primarily between 1880 and up until about the 1930s. They're very modest structures, kind of low to mid-rise, 2 to 6 floors in height. And they were intended for really modest income individuals to stay. So they're small rooms. And literally, there's very little room for anything in the room other than maybe a bed. Bathrooms are always located in the hall, so it's kind of like a dormitory style.
And people would, I presume, when we're talking about residents, these are not places that people would go to stay for a night or two necessarily.
You know, I think the benefit of residential hotels is that you literally could stay for however long you wanted to. So there were a lot of people that would stay for a night, a couple of nights, a week, a month, and there were a lot of people who ended up staying literally their lifetime.
Why did they exist? What role did they play in the economy of that period of time?
Around 1880, you start to see a lot of immigration into the country and a lot of migration into cities, because this is the place where they had opportunities for work. In the early years, you could stay in a residential hotel for 5 cents, 10 cents, a quarter. If you were going to stay for a longer period of time, you'd get a special rate. So you might be able to stay in a residential hotel for a month for maybe anywhere from $7.50 to $10 for the month.
What were the perceptions of other, you know, of neighbors, of more affluent citizens, of kind of mainstream culture at the time toward the SROs in Chinatown International District?
Yeah, well, they definitely were looked at as individuals who were down on their luck. that these were, you know, I hate to say it, but they were looked at the time as being kind of the dregs of society. These were individuals that didn't have great social connections, that they were people who were alone and lonely. And it was looked at as a location of kind of moral depravity.
Can you tell me more about the culture of, like, one of these buildings, for example? I mean, would people know each other? Would there be, you know, places to interact? Or is there a life of a building? Or was it really just people kind of living out their own individual lives in their individual rooms?
It would be virtually impossible to live in a room without having any kind of interaction at all with people who are living in the building.
And especially if you share a bathroom.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, that you're going to be walking through the hallways, even if you wanted to eat something, because there weren't any kitchens, so there was no communal kitchen. There was no kitchen in the rooms because they were so incredibly small. So it was expected that your life was going to interact with the greater community and that you would leave the building to have that interaction. So it was incredibly lively.
What role did they play as a safety net for people of modest means who needed a roof?
You know, Seattle, right around the turn of the 20th century, was going through, all this is going to sound so familiar and so contemporary, but we were going through a housing crisis. We didn't have enough housing to provide for people that were coming into the city for work opportunities. And so the residential hotels were, they were the places where you knew that you could get a room at least temporarily. Maybe you want it just for a couple of nights while you're looking for work. And then you could make longer-term decisions on where you ultimately wanted to stay. The people who would manage these hotels started to take a very strong interest in all of the individuals who would live in their buildings. One example, Mrs. Tokita took care of literally everybody who lived in the New Lucky Hotel. She was very mindful of the fact that there were a number of the residents that were, you know, strapped financially. There were also individuals that had problems with drug addiction, with alcoholism. And, you know, still, if you were the manager of one of these hotels, you took it very personally that these were the individuals that were under your care and under your charge.
Again, you gave this, the heyday is kind of the 1880s to, you know, 1930s Depression era. What happened after that to the residential hotels of Seattle?
The catalysts for closing residential hotels were major public works projects. So the interstates were being constructed. Typically, these would be located in areas of the city that were deemed kind of expendable areas. And those expendable areas, unfortunately, were often minority community areas. So we lost a number of residential hotels from that. And for Seattle, we had a major fire of one of the residential hotels that was located in the north part of the downtown. The fire was the second worst that had taken place in residential hotels in the nation. And the city started taking it very seriously because with the loss of life, they were also concerned with lawsuits. And so now all of a sudden, the city gave residential hotel owners 1 year to comply with fire codes. And for the people who owned and operated the hotels, these were never huge money-making operations. You know, people were just barely squeaking by a living. So all of a sudden, if you have a bill for upgrading the doors in your hotel alone, you know, at the time in 1972, we're talking about a bill for $11,000, which right now in 2018 dollars would be about $57,000. Now, how are you going to do that if you're charging, you know, $10 a month? They just couldn't do it. You know, the city thought that the worst that could happen was that we would probably lose about 1,000 low-income housing units. And it ended up being three times that amount within the first year of its passage.
Wow. Did that have a noticeable effect? I mean, where did those people go?
That's a good question. Nobody actually thought about the relocation of individuals. They didn't think about where the money was going to come from. You know, it's one thing to pass the ordinance, and it's another thing to say, well, we've got a plan in place that will help you with loans or will help you with some kind of a grant that would enable people who operated these hotels to stay in business.
What is the district like today? What are these buildings like today in the Chinatown International District? If we were to go take a walk down there, what would we see?
We still have a core group of residential hotels that are protected as part of the historic district of the CID. And I'm going to say they're in kind of varying states of vacancy, restoration. There are, I'm going to say, a couple of residential hotels that are still in operation, but they can't cater to that one-night stay anymore.
Yeah. And what would you say to somebody who says, okay, these residential hotels were pretty ugly, squalid, you know, they were basically a big kind of product of poverty. Why should we be celebrating them? You know, why do you think that they are worth knowing more about and kind of honoring the history of them?
You know, at the risk of shameless promotion, that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book Building Tradition, because I wanted people to understand the building type, the effect of urbanism, the need for low-income housing, the solution that people came to with providing these hotels, but also the lives of individuals who made their homes in these buildings, who raised their families in these buildings, and they were much, much more than just the brick and mortar that we look at now. These really were people's souls and their hearts and their lives, their history.
Marie Wong is the author of Building Tradition, Pan-Asian Seattle and Life in the Residential Hotels. You're listening to Sound Effect on KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Safety Net. Crystal Marks is an elected official in Burien. She's married, has a family, she volunteers. To all appearances, she's a picture of stability. But as a kid in Aberdeen, Crystal's life was anything but stable. She'd bounce between relatives' houses and sometimes have nowhere to go at all.
It was a difficult situation. I remember going to school and being in a uniform that I had to keep very clean at a Catholic school. And then at night, not knowing if we would be sleeping in a bed or under the bridge or at my, what I considered my home with my grandmother. And so I would wrap myself up in a blanket. I remember very vividly, it's a blue blanket, and I'd wrap up and try not to get dirty.
Crystal says in that environment, she was preoccupied with one uncertainty in particular, food. She'd get it however she could, and she'd hold on to it as best she knew how.
I tried shoving stuff in my pockets. I tried shoving stuff in my blankets, and that's when the rats became a problem. So for me, I became very overweight very quickly, which was very different at my dad's house with my dad and my stepmom. They always had food. There was always something there that we could eat, and I still would hoard stuff thinking it might disappear.
There was one place where there was always food, the local food bank.
I have mostly happy memories of going. It was places where we had other families, there were other kids, and a lot of the times the kids and I would run around. We would just play and talk and make, you know, do pretend games. And always we would dare each other to go and try to sneak some of the pastries or the baked goods or whatever they had there and just go and eat them out behind the building.
It was there that this future Burien City Council member got her first taste of serving others. Literally.
My family was volunteering at a lot of these places through the church that we were at. So we would make the meals. I remember we would always take on spaghetti. It was easiest to feed a large crowd. So that was a lot of fun for me. And I started realizing at that age, I think I had to have been around 10, between 10 and 15 is when we did it the most, that feeding people made people happy. I knew that. I knew eating made me happy. But giving them something that they didn't have really made them happy, and I got to be a part of that, and I started really getting into that side of service.
Fast forward to this year. Even though Crystal is a mother and a city council member, she still finds herself, on occasion, going to the food bank. Not as a volunteer, but as a client. She sort of came out about this in a Facebook post this year. It began, "I'm an elected official, and I go to the food bank." Crystal joined us to talk about how she ended up on both sides of this safety net and how it affects the way she governs.
My husband, being a combat veteran, has severe PTSD. He receives therapy at the VA. He goes 2 to 4 times a week, 4 different classes. But as such, he's unable to work. So I am the sole breadwinner for my family. City council is a part-time position, so they pay a stipend, but it's nothing that a family could live off of. It's not something that an individual could live off of, although it does definitely help. At the time, especially when I wrote the piece about going to food banks, I was working full-time and have been working full-time for years. So having to go to the food bank as the sole provider for my family, we now have 4 children total, my husband, myself, and 2 dogs, and still wanting to help feed the community. I do community soup events every full moon, just as a fun way to gather the community. I think over the last 2 years, we've gone there about 4 or 5 times. More so if there's been a job changeover and that payday overlaps. So the last time that I went, when I wrote the article on Facebook, that was exactly what had happened. I had switched jobs. Payday was 3.5 weeks away. I knew there was no way I could pay all these bills and feed my family. So being able to go to Tukwila and just stand in line and get food that was quality was key. So it was a good gap filler to carry us over.
Yeah. So what's a typical visit to the Tukwila Food Bank like? What does it look like and sound like, smell like?
So it is held in the basement of a church, of a Methodist church, off of Des Moines Memorial. Doors open at noon. People line up there as early as 9:30 or 10, which I did not know about. They didn't have on the website. So the first time I went, I showed up at 11:50, and there was a line almost wrapping around the building. And I knew I would not be getting in. And sure enough, I stood in line anyway. We really needed groceries. I stood in line and got inside of the door when they said, you know what, we're out. And there were still some people behind me and a couple people in front of me that wouldn't be getting in. And you could just feel it was like a wet blanket just sitting on your shoulders. And shortly after that was panic. So the next time that I went, I made sure to get there early. I got there at 10 and waited 2 hours, brought a book. Sometimes people get in fights over whether or not they were at that place in line. There's 1, maybe 2 people that check you in. You have to bring proof of your residency. And then you have to fill out a form that talks about everyone in your family, yourself, any other dependents, any other adults, any animals that you might be needing food for, front and back, social security numbers if known. And that part can take a while, and you might lose your spot in line if you haven't done it. You have to do it every year. So as you snake through and you get to the front, you think you're ready, you have to fill this out. And then they send you to different areas. If you are severely burdened, you get to go to one area. And if you're not, you go to another. They give you a large Costco-sized shopping cart, and then you wait in line again. And it's in this dark hallway. It's barely lit. There's a couple of light bulbs in there, and you're just waiting. And it's basically like going shopping. You have cases, cold cases on either side of you. Some are like the stand-up tall ones that are 7 feet tall and you can open up. Some are about hip height, and there's shelves as well. And you get to take however many it says on the sign by those cases. So it might say meat, take 3. Beans and rice, take as many as you want. And so you go through. A lot of people, I don't blame them, but a lot of people just take everything and they don't necessarily pay attention to the signs. Or you'll see families where it's a grandmother, a mother, and a son will go through and they each have a cart and they're all taking things. And so for me being behind them, part of me is like, yeah, get it. Feed your family. There might be 10 more of you at home that need this. Do what you can. And the other side of me is like, well, I kind of need to feed my kids too. And I feel guilty about that, knowing that, you know, I can afford to go and buy bread. That, you know, it's 99 cents. I can get bread. So why am I so worried about someone takes the last of the dry beans? It's okay. And they usually have a little pastry section at the end, which is always a happy part for me. And then they have this outside tent that's full of vegetables. And look like they just came straight from a farmer's market or the slightly about to expire food from stores. That's kind of what all the food inside looks like as well. Like the expiration date's maybe a week off. And you know you have to eat it quickly.
Like, what does it mean to you to be on both sides of the service equation there? To be both someone who volunteers and serves at service providers and food banks, and somebody who uses the service?
I think it just, it helps keep me grounded, helps me to be authentic. And when I'm creating policies, when I'm trying to govern a community, Burien is a community of over 52,000 people. And for me, that means knowing the whole spectrum of who lives there. And honestly, it's therapy for me in a lot of ways.
What do you mean?
I feel like I'm beating my past. I'm beating that feeling of needing to hoard. I'm beating that feeling of not being in control and being scared by empowering other people, even if it's just a little bit. Even if it's feeding them on the street or it's telling them about services. It's like, I hear you. I see what you're going through. I'm listening to the feelings that you're expressing. And being able to acknowledge that I can help someone else means that I'm in a place to do that. I'm stable enough to do it, even if I have to go and get services on occasion. And I remind myself there's no stigma about this. It's okay. We'll get through it. We have a food bank that has plenty of food.
Crystal Marks is a member of the City Council in Burien. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Sound Effect. On today's show, stories about the safety net. That term, safety net, we most often associate it with government programs, things like Medicaid, or public housing, food stamps. But those programs don't cover everything. And so a group of people in Olympia took this task to protect vulnerable people from the worst consequences of addiction and poverty on themselves. Sound Effect's Bethany Denton brings us the story.
It's a Monday evening in early autumn, and I'm waiting on a busy street in downtown Olympia when I see two women ride up on old mountain bikes, towing behind them large black bins. They're both young and petite, both dressed in black boots, black jeans, and black hoodies, and they're here on behalf of an anarchist organization that is unique to Washington's state capital.
A volunteer-run, bicycle-based, 365-night-a-year street outreach program with basic emergency supplies and syringe exchange and naloxone distribution.
In Olympia,
Washington.
That's Cassie Burke. She's been volunteering for more than 14 years.
This organization is called the Emma Goldman Youth and Homeless Outreach Project, or Iggy Hop. My favorite definition of anarchy is just when people are able to have self-determination. And so I don't believe it's all right for one giant authority to be able to dictate the terms of other people's lives.
The Emma Goldman Youth and Outreach Project gets its name from one of the most prolific radical anarchists of the 20th century. Emma Goldman believes strongly in, as Cassie calls it, self-determination, believing that every human being deserved the right to make their own decisions about how to live their lives.
I'm long-haired David, and I'm a street outreach worker here in Olympia for the injecting drug community. And it's our social responsibility to try to protect ourselves and that community from the disease of HIV and AIDS.
At the height of the AIDS epidemic in the early 1990s, a man who goes by the name Long-haired David was tired of seeing the disease spread in his community. This was at a time before antiretroviral cocktails, and a lot of people were dying. Inspired by the words of his idol, Emma Goldman, he and some of his friends started riding their bikes around the city to ask people, particularly IV drug users, how they could help. Here's Tracy, one of Eggy Hop's original riders and the group's longest-standing volunteer.
We started out with just peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Okay, that's our very humble beginnings. And it actually grew to people's basic needs, and it just kind of grew out from that.
This was also around the same time that Washington State was pioneering harm reduction services, including the first ever government-sanctioned needle exchange in Tacoma. Harm reduction refers to the basic idea that addiction is complex and people who are using drugs still deserve access to life-saving measures like clean supplies and opiate reversal drugs like naloxone. And that's why Eggy Hop is not so much in the business of evangelizing sobriety as it is trying to give people supplies that will help keep them safe right now. Volunteers tell me that for Eggy Hop, the philosophy is first and foremost to build connections with the people who need it most.
And so the next time I see you and you tell me that you never share your syringe anymore, that's excellent. Keep that up, you know, and I'll be here for you. You come on, see me, and I'll have clean rigs for you and condoms, and we'll talk about, we'll see about getting you in to see the doctor, and maybe one of these days you and I'll sit down and we'll talk about getting clean.
Hi, Kim. How you doing?
Not much has changed with Eggy Hop since the days of PB&J sandwiches. Here's Krista Kohler. She's the other volunteer tonight. She and Cassie have been riding together every Monday night for more than 7 years.
For me, like, riding on Mondays is just, like, such a beautiful way to start the week. Hi, Becca. You guys need anything? So we have two bikes that all riders use. They're both just old mountain bikes, and we have these burly trailers that are attached to the back. One is attached securely, the other one is attached via plastic ties, and we have this big red Sharps container attached here where we'll collect all the dirty rigs that we get for the night. Oh, hell yeah.
Wait, what just happened?
Something just fell off, and so I'm trying to put it back on. It's a little ramshackle, but it gets it done. Just the amount of need in Olympia has increased quite a bit, and so the amount of supplies we bring down every night has increased quite a bit, and they don't necessarily fit as well as they used to. So it's just kind of a random jumble of, like, what can we bungee to this thing today? Did the bungee break? Do we have bike inner tube? Do we have rope? Do we have anything? We'll make it work. We'll make it work. And I just picked up this big bag full of pastries. We've got, like, an entire bundt cake, it looks like, and incredible croissants.
Good haul.
Good haul.
Do you want to just jam it in here?
I'll just jam it in there. So one thing that is, I know that this seems a little wild because there's just stuff flying everywhere, but this will all be gone in 20 minutes.
Eggy Hop volunteers are out every night, 365 nights a year, rain or shine. The volunteer shifts start at around 7 p.m. when they pick up donated food and coffee from downtown businesses, and then they move to a sidewalk near the bus depot and Interfaith Community Center. Tonight, Cassie and Krista park the bikes near a mostly empty parking lot. By the time they arrive, there are already a few people waiting for them, smiling, happy to see their friends arrive with pizza and coffee.
Do you mind describing the scene here?
Yes, there is about, I'd say around 20 people standing around, some folks I've known for a long time.
Soon, there's a bustle of people around, even a few families with kids and strollers. Some folks are just passing through, and others seem to know each other, sharing cigarettes and pastries.
And some folks, like, will have had a hard day, and so if we've known them for a long time, they'll want to talk through that, and so we try to be available to that while also, like, making sure that we're getting people what they need when they need it.
One of the bike bins is full of clothing, especially socks, and that one's the free bin. People are encouraged to go through and take whatever they need, and as the weather turns cold, Krista tells me that they'll start putting in tarps, sleeping bags, and tents for the people who are living outside. The second bike bin has medical supplies and is set up next to the Sharps container. This is where the needle exchange happens.
I'm just putting a little kit together for someone. In this bag, I am putting together a bag of clean rigs and then all the supplies that we have. Hi, Terry. So that consists of alcohol wipes, which is really important to keep the skin clean before injecting. We pass out sterile water. We have clean cottons that we have individually bagged up. And a little cooker container that's all clean. And then ties for people.
Just that?
What would you say to someone who would see your work with Eggy Hop as encouraging drug use or as ultimately like a negative thing? Because I understand that that is not an abstract question. That is something you come up against.
I don't necessarily buy into the idea of enabling, because I think that folks that are already using drugs, already living on the streets, already just kind of submerged in that kind of lifestyle, like, that's just where they're at. Like, and I don't think that, like, it's anybody's place to
feel like as a culture we can give people permission to live their own lives the way that they're at. And I just think that that kind of gatekeeping is really disingenuous to like the kind of world I want to be in. Drug use is scary. Poverty is scary for people. A lot of the time it's scary because it's really close. And I see a really big hole in our world, like in our town, in our world, where it's just like people aren't being taken care of and their humanity isn't being recognized. And it just feels really important to me to be part of something that just kind of fills that gap, even though we don't do it perfectly all the time. But I just, like, I see a need and I want it to be addressed.
Eggy Hop is community. Eggy Hop is connection. Pizza delivery. It's instant coffee. It's a sock exchange. It's a safety net.
Check out that moon. Almost a full moon tonight.
I met Cassie and Krista stay until they're out of supplies, and by about 10:30, they're ready to call it a night. The two of them pack up, hop on the bikes, and ride off.
That story from Sound Effects' Bethany Denton. Sound Effect is produced by Jennifer, Kevin Kniestead, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Will James, Bethany Denton, and Paul Currington of Fresh Ground Stories. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. If you're looking for your next favorite podcast, look no further. Subscribe to Sound Effect on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever you get that sort of thing. You can also tell your smart speaker to play Sound Effect, the podcast. And your feedback is really important to us. You can send it to soundeffect@knkx.org. We're back next week when our theme is The Kids Are All Right. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.